Welcome to the UNLV Gaming Podcast, presented by the Center for Gaming Research at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Furthering the public's understanding of gambling and casinos with a mix of lectures and conversations.
Hey, hello everybody. Thank you for coming out on this very windy Monday afternoon to today's Gaming Research Colloquium Talk. Today we are lucky enough to hear from Edington Fellow Alice Kupfer, who's going to be talking about his research into the World Series of Poker. His talk is called The Biggest Game on TV, Benny Binion, the WSOP, and the Nostalgic Construction of Poker's Past. So, Alex.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you, everyone, for coming out today. And I wish to particularly thank the UNLV Special Collections and the Center for Gaming Research for hosting me these past few weeks. Can you hear me okay?
Oh, great.
All right, so the 46th Annual World Series of Poker, or WSOP, wrapped up last Tuesday as Joe McKeon outlasted over 6,400 players in the $10,000 No Limit Texas Hold'em World Championship to win $7.7 million. The WSOP has become a major sporting event for companies including Harrah's Gaming, which purchased the rights to the event in 2004, and ESPN, which has produced and broadcast the World Series since 2003. Yet, it would be barely recognizable to Benny Binion, who brought the World Series to his Binion's Horseshoe Casino in downtown Las Vegas in 1970. In comparison to today, when the WSOP first adopted the tournament format in 1971, only six players entered, and Johnny Moss took home the entire $30,000 prize pool with little press fanfare. The media coverage of the WSOP has historically served as a site for the production of different forms of nostalgia, constructing idealized versions of both poker and Benny Binion's past. Even before Benny started the World Series, he was already something of a Las Vegas legend. He had arrived from Dallas in 1946 with a lengthy rap sheet after having been accused or convicted of various crimes, including illegal gambling, bootlegging, and even two murders. After Binion founded the Horseshoe in 1951, it quickly became one of the most profitable casinos in Las Vegas. In large part through the World Series, Binion was able to shed this quote-unquote gangster image in favor of an increasingly romanticized public persona, which framed him as a patriarchal cowboy who indelibly shaped Las Vegas and poker culture in the United States. The discourses around the television and press coverage of the World Series, particularly in the 70s and 80s, which I'll be focusing on, reveals a great deal about how the history of poker and the development of Las Vegas after World War II has been remembered and shared in the media. Specifically, through considering how Benny's public persona developed over the years, we can see how televised sporting events like the World Series of Poker invoke, shape, and organize memories and images of the past to create a version of history which is quote-unquote usable for media institutions and large corporations. The material within the Binion's Horseshoe Collection in the UNLV Special Collections sheds light on the historical, social, and economic context which informed the representation of gambling in print and broadcast media. Even though Benny Binion himself never ran the tournament, a task which was done by his son Jack, the WSOP was defined by and defined Benny Binion's public persona, as many notable events of his life were recast and mythologized to more closely align with the narratives used to promote the Horseshoe and the World Series of Poker as a televised sporting event. In this way, the television broadcasts and promotional materials of the WSOP have served as a site for what film scholar Annette Kuhn describes as memory work, for the staging and performance of memories related to Binion and Las Vegas. Kuhn argues that memory neither represents nor provides access to the past as it were. Rather, the past is taken to be mediated and indeed produced in the activity of remembering. As is the case with the World Series and Benny's biography, many of the actual events have been lost to history or subsumed by the legends. Yet, even when this is the case, the activity of remembering remains significant in and of itself, since it highlights how nostalgia has been used in the context of sports media and how nostalgia has shaped popular attitudes towards poker throughout the 20th century. So much of Benny's early history comes directly from the man himself. So what we know is that in 1922, when he was around 18 years old, Benny Binion left the small town of Pilot Grove, Texas, where he had worked as a horse trader, and headed for El Paso. He got involved in bootlegging, helping to smuggle alcohol across the Mexican border, and he was arrested at least once while there. For unknown reasons, he did not remain in El Paso for very long, moving to Dallas after about a year. Doug J. Swanson explains that Binion quickly established himself as a middleman in the liquor business, quote-unquote, quote, the modern-day equivalent of the importer-distributor, end quote. Binion transported and protected the booze from the rural stills to the speakeasies in town, while of course taking a significant cut for himself. He was arrested at least twice more, later telling an interviewer that he received sentences of 60 days and 4 months respectively. Binion soon expanded from bootlegging to illegal gaming, opening a policy game in 1928. Numbers policies were basic lotteries in which players bet a dime to try and pick three correct numbers and win $10. He became somewhat of a pragmatic gambling boss who engendered loyalty through his generosity. For instance, stories circulated that he would pass out turkeys around Thanksgiving and load up trucks with apples and oranges during the Christmas season and distribute the fresh fruit in the poorer black neighborhoods where almost all his customers were. But Binion could also be a menacing gangster who would use brutal violence to ensure that his illegal business interests stayed his and to expand his territory. Swanson recounts an incident where Benny jammed a pencil in the eye of one of his number runners after the runner pocketed some of the money. Benny was also charged during this period with two murders. While he claimed self-defense both times, although his story sort of changed over the years a bit, he avoided spending a single day in jail either time. Benny was making more and more connections in the Dallas gaming world throughout this period. He met and began working for Warren Diamond, who ran a successful no-limit craps game. This willingness to take bets of any size would later become a hallmark of Binion's. Using the profits from his policy games, Benny also bought a 50% interest in the Topo Hill Club, a luxurious gaming den which was patronized by high-stakes bettors, including oil man H.L. Hunt, one of the richest people in America at the time, movie stars such as Mae West, Will Rogers, W.C. Fields, and Buster Keaton, and even a young Howard Hughes. Binion's growing influence around town was further bolstered by his increasingly close relationship with law enforcement, including the Dallas County Sheriff. His connections had helped once before, as Binion later cloyingly acknowledged that he had bribed the DA to drop the charges in his second murder case. Binion explained to Mary Ellen Glass in an oral history interview housed at UNLV how this influence helped him. The police would come in and raid his games, but would not destroy any of the property or gaming equipment. Rather, he would pay large fines that he estimated to be around $600,000 a year, which, though substantial, easily let him stay in business. Binion explained, quote, the town got in a bad financial condition. We made a deal to pay so many fines a week, so much a week, end quote. Benny, therefore, did not consider these payments to be a bribe, but rather his civic duty to help out the struggling town of Dallas. He also forged a symbiotic relationship with Dallas's law enforcement. He would often ask the sheriff to raid his gambling rivals, and in turn, the sheriff's office would ask Benny to drive out undesirable individuals from town. In a bid to obtain the 1936 Texas Centennial Exposition at the World's Fair, Dallas civic leaders effectively legalized gambling and other forms of vice. They wanted to seem like a major thriving metropolitan. Binion set up a gaming operation in the downtown Southland Hotel. In one of the rooms in the South End, there was always a craps game going, with players using chips stamped with a horseshoe logo. Soon, Benny or his partners ran dice games, slots, and bookmaking operations in at least a dozen different spots around town. And there were many other operators who paid him 25% of their take to guarantee their protection and safety. To ensure that he would receive his cut and that the competition stayed away, Binion hired a growing number of enforcers to protect the games and go after any potential rivals, violently if need be. Thanks to these enforcers and his close relationship with police, by the mid-40s, Binion effectively controlled the gaming in Dallas. Yet, in 46, Benny was forced to leave town after, as he memorably put it, quote, my sheriff lost the election. With a new reform administration in place, Binion decided to head out west for a new start in Las Vegas, where they had, of course, legalized gambling. With $1 million in cash in the trunk of his Cadillac, which was driven by his African-American chauffeur, Gold Dollar, Binion came to Las Vegas and purchased a large ranch house on Bonanza Road near the black neighborhood. He used the money he brought with him also to invest in the Las Vegas club on Fremont Street. While the Las Vegas Club itself was relatively bare bones, Binion was able to do well by once again instituting higher betting limits than anywhere else. Yet this willingness to risk significant losses frustrated his partners. And when they moved across, when they moved the Las Vegas Club across the street, Benny stayed in the place and opened up the Westerner Casino. However, once again unhappy with his partners, in 1941, he purchased the bankrupt El Dorado Club and renamed it the Binion's Horseshoe Casino. Benny, however, was initially unable to escape his criminal past in Texas. When the Kefauver Senate Crime Committee came to Las Vegas in November 1950, Binion was one of the people who had been subpoenaed. Seeking to avoid public exposure for his past crimes, Benny fled to his Montana ranch and was able to successfully avoid testifying. Binion, however, was unable to avoid efforts to extradite him to Texas to face charges for federal income tax evasion and operating an illegal policy wheel. After trying to fight the charges for a number of years, in December 1953, Benny pleaded guilty and was sentenced to pay $776,000 in back taxes and interest and to serve 5 years in the federal penitentiary at Leavenworth. He returned home after serving 3.5 years, but was never again able to have a gaming license. Since the 1970s, two narratives have dominated discussions of Benny's early years in Las Vegas. Both of these narratives evade much in-depth discussion of his criminal background or his time in prison. The first narrative is that focuses on the innovations in the casino industry that he instituted. The second encompasses his generosity towards employees, customers, and the community at large. The Horseshoe was the first downtown casino to install carpeting and to give all its patrons, not just the high rollers, free drinks. Seeking to cultivate a reputation for the best customer service in town, Binion paid his dealers and bartenders considerably more than anywhere else. The Horseshoe, too, became famous for its dining, featuring Benny's own jailhouse chili recipe and steaks which came from his own ranch in Montana. Stories abounded about Benny's willingness to help desperate people out. One widely circulated tale concerns a man who became hysterical after losing big at a craps table. Accounts differ whether it was $1,000 or $10,000. When Benny found out that the gambler was a Baptist minister who had lost his congregation's money, he returned the losses and told the minister, quote, "The Lord will forgive you, but the congregation won't," end quote. Some variations of the story also claim that Benny later received a check for the money with a letter of gratitude from the Reformed minister. Binion bolstered his reputation through more public acts of generosity as well. In 1950, for instance, he donated $1,000 to the University of Nevada men's basketball team to cover their travel expenses to the AAU National Basketball Tournament in Kansas City. So the Horseshoe soon became the most profitable casino in Glitter Gulch. Binion even claimed that one year, he did not specify which one though, his casino took in 54% of all the money in downtown Las Vegas. By the mid-60s, Benny really began to emphasize that his was a family-owned and operated casino, distinct from Las Vegas's increasingly corporately controlled casinos. Promotions for the Horseshoe routinely highlighted how his sons Jack and Ted ran the daily operations at the casino, with Ted in control of the gaming side and Jack running the business side, and later on the World Series. Benny's wife managed the casino cage and could be seen there every day as well, making the bank deposits. To compete with the publicly traded and well-funded corporations that began entering Las Vegas gaming in the 60s, the Horseshoe looked for new and innovative ways to promote itself to the public. In 1964, Benny installed a display of $1 million in cash composed in $10,000 bills, encased in plastic, and housed in a 7-foot-high plastic horseshoe frame. It quickly became one of the more popular tourist attractions in Las Vegas, and tens of thousands posed for pictures with it every year. There's even a picture of Charles Manson with his family, very young Charles Manson. To highlight Benny's knack for drawing attention to his casino and knowing exactly what the masses wanted, later press releases would claim that Benny was inspired by a family trip to the U.S. Mint in Washington, D.C. However, the idea actually seems to have come initially from Joe W. Brown, who installed a $1 million display in 1954 while Benny was in Leavenworth. The World Series of Poker likewise grew out of a desire to promote the Horseshoe Casino to as wide an audience as possible. Specifically, the event began as a way to promote high-limit gaming, since the Horseshoe did not have a poker room at the time and would not until 1988 when it purchased the next-door Mint Casino. The only time, therefore, poker was spread at the Horseshoe before 88 was during the few weeks each year of the World Series. And I should note here that while the main event, or the $10,000 no-limit hold'em tournament, garners nearly all of the attention from the press and public, the World Series is actually a large series of events, encompassing a number of preliminary tournaments, featuring different variations of poker, as well as very lucrative side games. So over the years, Binion was credited with an increasingly central role in the development of poker in Las Vegas. Although there were numerous factors which inspired the creation of the WSOP, the ones which credited Binion alone with the creation of the World Series, such as setting up the legendary no-limit game between Johnny Moss and Nick the Greek Dandelos, which I'll discuss shortly, were emphasized in promotions and television coverage at the expense of other events, such as the proliferation of casino-sponsored sporting events in the 50s and the 1969 Texas Gamblers Reunion in Reno. So the no-limit poker game between Nick the Greek and Johnny Moss is now considered to be one of the seminal events in the history of poker. Yet, despite being constantly retold, many of the most basic facts of the event are in dispute. For instance, while the game almost certainly occurred in 1949 at the Westerner, because the horseshoe later became so closely associated with high-stakes poker, many incorrectly assumed that it took place there in 1951. So, as the legend goes, Binion was approached one day by renowned gambler Nick the Greek Dandelos, who had recently arrived in Las Vegas after claiming to have busted every high-stakes gambler on the East Coast and winning $60 million in the process. Frustrated that all the poker in Las Vegas at the time was limit poker, which players can only bet or raise certain amounts, Dandelos approached Binion looking to play a one-on-one, no-limit, winner-take-all game. Sensing a publicity opportunity for his casino, Binion agreed to arrange a match, reportedly on the condition that the game would be played on the casino floor in full view of the public. Binion asked his friend Johnny Moss, a poker player that he knew from his days in Texas, to fly out. With the game placed at the Westerner's entrance, Jim McManus claims that Moss and Dandelos' ability to concentrate was affected as, quote, 200 or 300 chattering railbirds hemmed in at the table, end quote. The legend has it that the two men played virtually nonstop from January to May, pausing to rest only once every four to five days. After tremendous swings back and forth, after 5 months, Moss won all of Dandelos' money, supposedly between $2 and $3 million. Despite the suggestions that the game was a massive publicity boon to Binion, and that there were large crowds constantly watching the action, there do not seem to be any written accounts or photographs of the game while it was taking place. Furthermore, poker historian Michael Craig notes that articles on poker in the 50s and 60s likewise failed to mention the game. And any reference to the game is also noticeably absent from Dandelos' front page obituaries in both the Las Vegas Sun and Review Journal, as well as in a Life magazine feature about him published shortly after his death. And despite the supposed importance of the game to the World Series of Poker, Binion himself rarely referenced it. For instance, in two oral history interviews from 1973 and 1975 at UNLV, or that are housed at UNLV, even though Benny discusses a number of key moments in the early history of the horseshoe, and even discusses Nick the Greek, he never actually brings up the matchup between Moss and Dandelos. However, the mythology around the game continued to grow over the years, bolstering Benny's legacy in two important ways. First, it was used to reinforce Binion's horseshoe's claim to being the center of poker culture after World War II, even if the game took place at the Westerner. Second, this legend also offers a teleological rereading of the success of the World Series of Poker, hereby crediting Benny Binion with having the foresight to see how high-stakes poker could become a popular spectator sport really about 20 years before anyone else recognized this. The importance of the Moss-Dandelos game has overshadowed the other catalysts which influenced the creation of the World Series of Poker, including the 1969 Texas Gamblers Reunion. Early that year, Tom Moore of the Holiday Hotel in Reno invited Benny and Jack Binion, as well as a number of high-stakes poker players, to his hotel for a week of poker action. When Moore decided not to hold another reunion the following year, largely because the poker players never migrated to the gaming tables, as he had hoped, the Binions decided to hold their own gathering at their casino. Despite the obvious connections to the World Series, the Texas Gamblers Reunion has really been relegated to a de facto footnote by many historians. Catching Benny's eye is interesting, but not as an event which directly provided a blueprint for the first World Series of Poker in 1970. Along with these two catalysts, I would also argue that an important but overlooked influence on the creation of the WSOP was a significant number of sporting events that Las Vegas casinos held in the 1950s. Significant number of sporting events are in the 1950s. In his dissertation, The Best City of Them All, A History of Las Vegas, 1930-1960, Perry Kaufman notes that during this period, Las Vegas casinos began sponsoring pool tournaments, fishing contests, boat regattas, and quick draw pistol tournaments. After the Desert Inn opened on the Strip in 1952, Wilbur Clark hosted the Tournament of Champions professional golf tournament until 1966, when the casino was sold to Howard Hughes. Winners of the prestigious event included Sam Snead, Jack Nicklaus, and Arnold Palmer. Notably, NBC covered the event every year that it was held, first on radio and then on television, where it was sponsored by Goodyear Tire. These events continued in the 1960s, most notably with Evel Knievel's motorcycle jump at Caesar's Palace, which Dave Schwartz credits with solidifying the connection between sport and spectacle in Las Vegas. So the World Series of Poker, thus, not only built on this established tradition of casino sponsoring and organizing sporting events, but also using broadcast media to promote the event and the casino where it was held. In his book, The Biggest Game in Town, Al Alvarez notes that in the first years of the World Series of Poker, everything was amateur about it except the players. It took a number of years for the familiar structure to take place. The first World Series in 1970 did not involve a tournament. Rather, Johnny Moss was voted best all-around players by his fellow participants after several days of high-stakes cash games. Ted Thackeray, a sports writer for the Los Angeles Times, who was one of the few to cover the first event, suggested that to get the public's attention, Binion needed to add some structure to give the event more drama. The following year, the WSOP moved to a freeze-out structure, a tournament where players cannot rebuy if they're out of chips, and which is played until one person has all the chips. This also gave the tournament a narrative structure, a clear beginning, middle, and end. The tournament's publicity was initially handled by a different Greek, Jimmy the Greek Snyder, a well-known bookie and television sports personality, most famous for his 12-year run as co-host of CBS's The NFL Today pregame show, where he would predict the scores of the upcoming games. Eager to promote his new public relations business, Snyder had volunteered to promote the WSOP for free. The Horseshoe actively courted reporters, offering to pay for their trip to cover the event. At the 1972 World Series, not only was there a special section close to the action set up for these reporters, but Benny spent much of the tournament regaling them with stories and jokes. Benny was a remarkably charming person. As former WSOP publicity director Tex Whitson explained in an oral history interview, quote, Benny could talk to a host and get information, end quote. In other words, Benny had a knack for getting people to talk to him and ultimately getting them on his side. Binion claimed that in 1972, the World Series received mention in 7,000 newspapers across the country, and many of them, of course, specifically mentioned Benny and his outsized personality. The first widespread exposure that the World Series had on television did not actually come from the tournament itself, but rather through Thomas Austin Preston, better known as Amarillo Slim, who made dozens of TV appearances after winning the WSOP main event in 1972. That year's tournament itself was small, with only 8 entrants, who each put up a $5,000 entry fee. The $5,000 was actually matched by Binion, thus raising the prize pool to $80,000 for the winner, since Binion believed that the nice round number of $10,000 made for a much more impressive newspaper headline. The 72 World Series was not broadcast on television, but a video camera was placed over the poker table to relay the action to closed-circuit televisions that were placed all over the casino. After he won the main event, Amarillo Slim became a de facto touring ambassador for the game, and through his numerous TV and radio appearances, tirelessly promoted poker, Binion's Horseshoe, and of course himself. Slim claimed that several casino owners had asked him to even clean up poker's reputation, saying that he should articulate for the public how poker required incredible skill, not just luck. Slim soon appeared on The Tonight Show 11 different times, 60 Minutes three times, as well as Good Morning America, The Mike Douglas Show, and game shows including To Tell the Truth, What's My Line, and I've Got a Secret. Slim's success as a television personality pushed Benny Binion towards the medium as well. After accidentally neglecting to mention the Horseshoe Casino during one of his Tonight Show stints, Slim arranged for a joint appearance with an initially reluctant Benny on NBC's The Tomorrow Show, a late-night talk show hosted by Tom Snyder. In May 1974, the two men put on what Slim later described as, quote, an hour's commercial for the Horseshoe. Snyder's questions gave Benny the opportunity to explain his casino's policy in his own folksy way. Snyder, for instance, asked at one point, why is it that these places out there on the Strip in Vegas have a $500 limit and you've got no limit? To which Benny replied, quote, well, they've got great big hotels and little bitty bankrolls. I got a little bitty hotel and a great big bankroll, end quote. Benny considered his appearance a success, and 2 years later actually appeared on the Merv Griffin Show, along with poker pro Jack Strauss and actor Jack Klugman, best known as the poker-playing Oscar Madison, on CBS's The Odd Couple. As a result of these publicity efforts, the 1973 World Series was the first one that was filmed for television audiences. Jimmy the Greek Snyder served as both producer and narrator for an hour-long special that aired on CBS. The 1973 special was shot with handheld cameras and extensively utilized zoom lenses, giving it a visual style much more similar to cinema documentaries at the time than the aesthetically sparse coverage of poker that would later become the norm. The atmosphere in and around Binion's is also emphasized throughout. For instance, after the first day's action wraps up, Snyder ruminates about the empty Fremont Street at 3 a.m. The ambient soundscape of the horseshoe is also quite prominently featured. So in addition to Snyder's narration, we can hear the constant crowd noise, chattering of chips, and players constantly talking amongst themselves. The emphasis on the ambiance at Binion's also allows for the broadcast to directly incorporate a lengthy advertisement for the casino. Over a montage of people gambling, Snyder explains that Binion's games had appealed to all. He states, quote, from the nickel slot players to the dollar blackjack enthusiasts, to those who are willing to pit their luck in the highest crap games in the world. There is no limit to any game as far as Benny Binion is concerned. If you got the money, put it on the table, he'll take the bet, end quote. Anticipating the convergence of the horseshoe's public relations efforts and TV coverage of the WSOP in the 1980s, Snyder here brought together his roles as the Horseshoe's publicist and the executive producer of the CBS broadcast to promote the casino's gambling to a national audience. Benny made a cameo appearance in the 73 broadcast, portrayed here as a family man. Snyder explains, quote, as a spectator sport, poker watching doesn't rate with some of the great events of this country, but it has a fascination all its own. Even Benny Binion, an old homesteader out of Texas, got the family for a close-up look at the action. Benny is shown amongst the crowd, you know, not amongst the players, but amongst the crowd, watching the action with his wife, Teddy Jane, and his son, Ted. The use of the phrase homesteader here is notable, too, implying that Benny came to Las Vegas as part of the long American tradition of people moving to the frontier for a better life and not to escape his criminal past. After Doyle Brunson won back-to-back main event titles in 76 and 77, the World Series returned to television in 1978 as part of the CBS Sports Spectacular anthology series. Similar to its more famous counterpart, ABC's Wide World of Sports, the CBS Sports Spectacular series aired sporting events that were not popular enough for their own broadcasts. Snyder and his NFL Today co-host Brent Musburger called the action when it reached the final six players. Inspired by the dominating performance of a 28-year-old Bobby Baldwin, who would go on to become the youngest player to win the main event, one of the more notable parts of the 78 broadcast were the interviews with former champions Johnny Moss and Puggy Pearson, where each was asked about the potential threat that young players pose to the older generation of gamblers. It becomes sort of a common trope in broadcasts of the World Series to this day. This topic of the struggle between young and old players, or the mathematically inclined players versus the more instinctual ones, was also intended to garner nostalgia for the Texas road gamblers who were closely associated with Binion, including Moss, Pearson, Amarillo Slim, and Doyle Brunson, and who were seemingly under the constant threat of being usurped by the younger generation of players who had only played in Las Vegas. CBS returned to Binion's the following year, hoping to exploit the connections between the World Series and Kenny Rogers' number one single about poker, The Gambler. The show opened with a montage set to the song, Traveling to the Horseshoe. The final shot of the montage is of Amarillo Slim riding a horse down Fremont Street and handing the reins to Benny in front of the casino. Announcer Frank Lieber explains, quote, to greet them all, the legendary Benny Binion, whose golden rule is that those who have the gold make the rules, quote. This unspoken cameo would actually be Benny's last appearance in a World Series broadcast, but the discourses around him would continue to influence how the event was represented on television. Also in 79, the Horseshoe bolstered its claim to being the center of poker culture in the U.S., when it created the Poker Hall of Fame. Binion had plaques installed in the casino to honor each inductee. Among the six members of the inaugural class were Nick the Greek Dandelos and Johnny Moss, whose game, of course, allegedly inspired the creation of the World Series. The Hall of Fame display would be used as a backdrop for many television interviews over the years, constantly reminding viewers about the connection between Benny Benny's Casino and poker history. The 1979 broadcast, for instance, included an interview with famous pool player and television personality Minnesota Fats, standing in front of the plaques, who was then asked to talk about the new inductees of the Hall of Fame that he knew personally. In 1978, seeking to expand the coverage of the World Series, Jack Binion hired highly regarded Hollywood publicist Henry Bollinger to promote the horseshoe. Bollinger produced dozens of press releases each year, fortunately preserved at UNLV Special Collections. These established or solidified a set of narratives around the World Series. These narratives served to legitimate poker as a middle-class entertainment form and also create a nostalgic framework for defining Binion's role in the development of poker. Bollinger, who had produced two theatrical features, would soon produce the annual World Series TV broadcast as well. In 1981, after CBS declined to pick up its broadcast option for the WSOP, Bollinger's Transor Films took over and produced a one-hour special for local syndication. Renowned baseball broadcaster Kurt Gowdy and 1978 champion Bobby Baldwin were hired to do that announcing duties. Jerry Adler, who had produced a WSOP broadcast for CBS, was hired once again to do the production duties here, giving the broadcast a similar aesthetic and visual style as before. To make the tournament more inviting to newcomers, over the years, the Horseshoe's promotional efforts strongly emphasized the ever-expanding role of amateurs and women. When amateur Hal Fowler won the main event in 1979, press releases touted the uniqueness of the World Series as a sporting event where amateurs could take on the professionals. Bollinger, too, sent out numerous press releases every year highlighting notable accomplishments by female poker players at the World Series, as well as the annual Women's Championship Tournament. Notably, though, other groups which were underrepresented at the WSOP, particularly African Americans, did not receive the same treatment from Bollinger and the Horseshoe. And the number of participants, therefore, never took off quite in the same way. So in an effort to court sponsors for the televised broadcasts, the promotional material published by Horseshoe throughout the 80s often highlighted that there were between 40 and 50 million poker players in the U.S. Demonstrating how efforts to transform the WSOP into a major sporting event influenced the nostalgic reconstruction of poker's past, these promotional materials published by Bollinger and the numerous magazine and newspaper articles which drew on them increasingly claimed that Benny Binion himself was a high-stakes poker player. However, as Binion explained to Mary Ellen Glass, while he had learned how to gamble at a young age, he never actually played poker. He said, quote, "I was never able to play anything, dice or cards or anything myself. I was never a real good poker player," end quote. And certainly once he got to Las Vegas, there is no evidence whatsoever to suggest that he ever played poker. But in trying to equate poker playing with the potential audience for WSOP broadcasts, the Horseshoe publicity machine transformed Benny's history, here making him a player. Bollinger also sought to legitimate the World Series as a televised sporting event by associating it with more established events. A press release first issued in 1981, titled "Poker as a Sport, a New Idea," compared the WSOP to other individual sports championships, such as Wimbledon, the Indianapolis 500, and the Masters. Accordingly, if the World Series was to be considered a sports media event, then the participants needed to be treated as athletes. In 1987, the television broadcast, produced by Translore and broadcast and aired on ESPN, even included a segment directly adapted from a press release showing players in training. It showed a handful of athletes working out, including former Navy frogman Puggy Pearson swimming laps in his home pool, and Jesse Alto jogging down Fremont Street. So the 87 World Series was the first one broadcast on ESPN, which at the time was still a fledgling cable network looking particularly for sports programming that the other networks were not interested in. It could not compete with CBS and NBC and ABC for the rights to major sporting events. At the time, ESPN routinely aired time-buy or brokered sporting events. These were typically produced by outside companies, which then paid ESPN to air it, often in exchange for a certain amount of ad time. In the case of the Horseshoe, instead of looking for outside sponsors, Jack Binion agreed to pay $100,000 to Bollinger and Translore Films to cover the production costs. In exchange, Translore agreed to have the 1987 broadcast aired on ESPN at least twice, and agreed to frequently mention Binion's as the site of the event and show Binion's signage around the casino. The Transo-produced broadcast thus in effect became hour-long infomercials for the horseshoe. Benny was beset by numerous health problems throughout the 1980s, including suffering three heart attacks. He died on Christmas Day 1989 at the age of 85. He was recognized as both a gaming pioneer as well as a venerated pillar of the community at the time of his death. Benny's most famous promotional idea outlived not only him, but also his horseshoe casino. In the 90s, hour-long specials of the World Series main event Final Table continued to be aired annually, either on ESPN or Discovery Channel. In 2003, recognizing that the online poker boom could bring in new television viewers, ESPN acquired the production rights, in addition to the broadcast rights, and expanded its coverage to 6 hours. It also employed for the first time the whole cam, which allowed viewers at home to see a player's cards on every hand that was shown. The broadcast was still heavily edited for time. Perhaps the most enduring story of the 2003 World Series of Poker, though, was that one of the online poker players, a Tennessee accountant named Chris Moneymaker, his actual name, was able to outlast 839 players and become the world champion. Thanks to the confluence of these factors, televised poker reached unheard of levels of popularity. ESPN executive Mark Shapiro explained in 2011 that since the network had acquired the production and broadcast rights 8 years earlier, the WSOP was the network's highest-rated series other than Sunday night NFL and Saturday college football games. The success of ESPN's coverage of the WSOP has helped introduce a diverse audience to tournament poker and grow the World Series itself to heights unimagined by Benny and Jack Binion. And of course, it also greatly bolstered the value of the WSOP. Soon after ESPN expanded its coverage of the event, Harrah's purchased the Horseshoe Gaming Corporation and the rights to the World Series for approximately $1.5 billion. In 2005, the World Series of Poker was moved to the Rio Hotel and Casino to better accommodate the more than 5,600 entrants. So in conclusion, after Binion died in 1989, the Horseshoe Casino unfortunately deteriorated. This was due to the general decline of downtown gaming, scandals surrounding the family, including the murder of Ted Binion, and a dispute between Jack and Becky Binion Bainin over how to operate the casino and the Horseshoe brand. As a result, the physical casino on Fremont Street was only a small part of the Harrah's deal. It was actually sold the next year for only $20 million. Despite this less than ideal ending for Binion's Horseshoe, the legacy of Benny Binion still continues to exert considerable cultural and economic influence. The Horseshoe and World Series brand hold significant values for companies like Harrah's and ESPN, as well as a whole range of sponsors. The main event of the World Series is still the most prestigious title in poker, as well as a single richest championship in sports. Ultimately, through considering how Binion's public persona developed over the years, we can see how televised sporting events like the World Series of Poker have used memories and images of Las Vegas' past to create a mythologized version of Las Vegas and poker history.
Okay, thank you very much, Alex. What were some questions?
This may be a little outside your research, but you mentioned that in the 1960s, the Binions promoted their hotel casino as family-owned as opposed to corporate-owned.
Right.
So I guess I'm looking for a definition of corporate. Are we talking about real corporations or families like syndicates?
Well, I think because it was in 61, I believe, that Del Webb Corporation purchased the Sahara and the Mint, and Howard Hughes came, I believe, in 64. So there was sort of this transitional period where I think, you know, the families and syndicates were pushed out in favor of sort of the publicly traded corporations. But from the outset, Benny sort of used that as a marketing tool. In the Binion's Horseshoe collection, there's actually a suggestion from an advertising company that the horseshoe follows AMC, the car company, how George Romney, Mitt Romney's father, became sort of the face of the company to give it sort of a non-corporate image in some ways. And it was suggested that Binion's does the same thing with Benny, Jack, and Ted becoming the face of the casino. It started in the 60s, but really sort of took off, I would say, more 70s and 80s.
Yeah, I'm wondering about specifically about the television aspect. You kind of referred to this, but there's a lot of talk now about how companies like ESPN basically cover the sports that they own the rights to because it's very self-interested for them, like college football, for example, and in the last 10 years, the NFL. So I'm wondering basically kind of like where the chicken and the egg is here, whether the World Series of Poker becomes this mainstream event, partly because ESPN buys the rights and has self-interest in broadcasting it and making it a sport that it can cover, or if that's tapping into a grassroots support for it and popularity, or if it's kind of like creating that and then it blossoms out from there.
I think it's both to some extent. One thing that was going on too in 2003, you have this huge internet poker boom, but you also have the rise of like the World Poker Tour, these big tournaments in other casinos as well. So the World Series was the most famous, but not the only one. So I'm not sure sort of if that pushed everything, right, how that sort of, but the World Series sort of set the template, I would say, for things like the World Poker Tour. But whether it could be credited with everything, probably not. It's probably both in, you know, the sort of convergence helps both ESPN and Binion's. That'd be my
guess. I have a question. So what do you think is the story between the Nick the Greek and Johnny Moss game? What really happened?
So that has largely been lost. It's not clear. The game certainly seems to have taken place, certainly for high stakes. We know that much. Beyond that, it's not really quite clear what happened. Most accounts actually say that it occurred at the Horseshoe in 1949, which of course is impossible because the Horseshoe wasn't created in 1951. So all these narratives just start out with sort of this impossibility. I believe it took place at the Westerner because everyone seems to agree that it occurred between January and May, but the Horseshoe did not open up until later in 1951. So occurred in 1949 at the Westerner, high stakes. Beyond that, it's really unclear. Nick the Greek died in 66 fairly early on, and Johnny Moss's sort of later history too just became enveloped in this mythology and outright lie. So it's really not quite clear, but I know Michael Craig, for instance, really just sort of cast out on all of it. Beyond that, it happened. But someone like Doyle Brunson says it did happen. Johnny Moss won a lot of money.
Why else do you think this is significant to the study of media and culture beyond just gambling and casinos?
Well, I think one of the things that it does is shows how sports media has to create sort of its own history, that it has to have these larger traditions that create these narratives for broadcast that provide a framework for understanding why the event you're watching is significant. Why does it matter? Just to give one example, when ESPN started producing in 2003, the first episode focused almost entirely on Doyle Brunson, the man sort of, you know, the most famous poker player in the country, certainly sort of the face of poker. So if you have this tradition, this past that you can build off of, it makes it so that corporations and television can use it and sort of air it and broadcast it in the way that they're used to, with these sort of broader narratives, broader structures and meaning.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Alex. Thank you to all of you. That was a fantastic talk. And if you'd like more information about what we do and future talks, you can go to gaming.unlv.edu. Thank you very much.
This has been the UNLV Gaming Podcast, presented by the Center for Gaming Research at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. The opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily represent those of UNLV, its staff, faculty, alumni, or benefactors. For more information, please visit us at gaming.unlv.edu.